Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Cities around the world are experiencing oppressive levels of heat. In South Japan recently, 2,000 people went to the hospital for heat exhaustion. High temperatures in parts of Scotland triggered speed restrictions on train routes, and the weatherproof roof on Glasgow's Science Center melted and dripped black goo down the building. In May, a heat wave killed more than 65 people in Pakistan. On Monday, May 4th, the temperature in Nawabasha, a city of 1.1 million people in southern Pakistan, was 122 degrees. Here in the United States, city officials in a number of cities have issued heat warnings, especially for seniors, children, and people with health issues and disabilities. According to the CDC, more than 600 people in the United States die from extreme heat every year. But environmental justice activists say that number is much higher. Last week, Peggy Frank, a postal carrier, died in her truck in Southern California. It was 117 degrees. Her truck did not have air conditioning. And then we have the fires. Hot, dry, and windy weather have sparked massive fires in the West. A blaze is currently burning just west of Yosemite National Park. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about how we should understand the link between climate change and extreme heat. What does science tell us about what we should expect in the coming years and decades? To explore these issues, we're joined by two guests. Noah Diffenbaugh is professor of Earth System Science at Stanford University, and he joins us from Palo Alto. Hi, Professor Diffenbaugh. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Dr. Daniel Swain is a climate scientist at the Center for Climate Science at UCLA and is the author of the Weather West blog. Hi, Dr. Swain. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have both of you. Noah, I want to start off with you. I mean, this is just overwhelming to even read about. In the city of Basra, there is a massive revolt happening right now. 115 degrees, lack of water, lack of electricity. There have been violent protests against the government in Iraq. There's so many examples. We weren't even sure which ones to put in the intro. Is this unprecedented?
Well, we're certainly experiencing unprecedented heat events around the world year after year. And this is documented from our long-term observations of temperature in different parts of the world. So we do know that the frequency of occurrence of record-breaking heat has been increasing. We also know from research that both I and Daniel and others have conducted that that increase in the probability and of record breaking heat, the intensity of individual heat events, that those have a clear human fingerprint in many cases. In our research that was published last spring, on which Daniel is also a co-author, we found that when we look across the globe, more than 80% of the record-setting hot events do have a human fingerprint. So we're not at the point where we can say that every single record hot event has been influenced by global warming, but we're getting awfully close.
Dr. Swain, what would you add? On July 5th, the Washington Post had a piece called Red Hot Planet. All-time heat records have been set all over the world during the past week.
Well, I think sort of to echo what Noah just said, you know, recently we have seen a particularly high number of high profile extreme heat events around the world, and especially in the Northern Hemisphere. And you know, these are heat waves are not a new process in the climate system, but they are one that has been increasing. So we are seeing more heat waves with greater frequency and greater intensity, and that overall trend towards increased frequency and intensity of heat waves in a global sense is a fingerprint of global warming. It doesn't necessarily mean that every heat wave has as its singular cause the long-term warming trend. A lot of these events might have occurred to some degree, with or without global warming. But what we mean when we say that that the vast majority of these events now have a human fingerprint is essentially that in most instances, the likelihood of seeing as severe a heat wave or as frequent of heat waves as we're now seeing would have been very unlikely without the emission of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere that we've been doing over the past decade.
Can you elaborate on that a bit? Because anytime we have extreme weather, we often ask whether it's related to climate change. So talk a little bit more about this, Dr. Swain. How can we for sure know? What does the science tell us about the connections between heat waves and climate change?
Well, you know, this is actually a conversation I've been having a lot in the last few weeks, specifically regarding these heat waves that we've been seeing, which is that, you know, sometimes you'll read a headline in the newspaper or somewhere else that might say global warming caused this extreme event. Or alternatively, you might read a headline that said global warming not to blame for a particular event. And I think really what both of those headlines miss is that there is some nuance in this statement, that the reality, the scientific evidence actually points to an answer that's somewhere in between those two extremes. In other words, it is possible for an event to have been influenced by global warming without necessarily having been singularly caused by it. And that's sort of where the science, the really interesting science is going on, is figuring out just how much of an influence global warming has had on a specific event or a specific type of event. Because when we talk about extreme events, sometimes we're talking about extreme heat events, heat waves. Sometimes we're talking about extreme precipitation, big downpours, or hurricanes, or blizzards, whatever it is. The answer can be different depending on the physical type of event, and the answer can be sort of a different magnitude, even from event to event, even in the same category. So we're even talking about heat waves in different parts of the world, for example. And so that's sort of where the cutting edge of the science is right now, and in sort of figuring out where that balance lies.
Professor Diffenbaugh, in one of your studies, you have found that global warming from human emissions of greenhouse gases has increased the odds of the hottest events across more than 80% of the globe for which reliable observations are available, while also increasing the likelihood of both wet and dry extremes. So what would you add when you talk about the science and what it tells us about the connections between extreme heat and climate change?
Well, I think you know what Daniel was saying is absolutely correct. And you know, another way of putting it is that no one's arguing that it would have been cold in Los Angeles over the last couple of weeks, or would have been, no one's arguing it would have been cold in Montreal, right? I mean, so the point is that that whenever we have extremes, there's always a big influence of noise, right? And that's what the atmosphere circulates, the ocean circulates. That's what brings the weather that we experience. And where global warming really plays a role is in influencing the severity of what we experience where we live. You know, it tips the odds, puts a thumb on the scale. And in our research, what we found is that, already the 1 degree Celsius of global warming that we've already experienced has put a thumb on the scale at more than 80% of the global surface area where we have reliable historical observations. That's for the record hot events. When we repeat that analysis for extreme downpours, as Daniel was mentioning, as well as periods of low precipitation, dry periods, we find that for those wet and dry events that global warming has already put a thumb on the scale at about half of the area. So, these are pretty substantial changes when it comes to what we experience on the ground, because our systems are really set up for the historical climate. They were designed and built based on the historical climate, both our infrastructure as well as our systems for putting out warnings for heat waves, for example, how we manage responding during heat waves. And, you know, what's very clear is that, you know, those odds have already changed, and that in order to be prepared, not only for the present, but also for the future, we're going to need to catch those systems up with the climate change that's already happened.
And for so many of us, especially if those of us who grew up in Northern California, for example, we're just not prepared, or, you know, it's hard to adapt to this kind of weather. And just in the last couple of weeks, Burbank Airport, 114 degrees, UCLA, 111, Ramona, 115, the Van Nuys Airport, 117. Again, all-time high temperatures. Dr. Swain, what does the science tell us about what we should expect in the coming years and the decades? Because when I have conversations with people about this, you know, a lot of people say, wow, if we're hitting 115 right now, what is it going to be like in 10 or 20 years? Is that the right question to be asking?
I think that is a reasonable question to be asking. And it's primarily because what we, you know, one of the clearest manifestations of global warming in a practical sense. Obviously, global average temperatures are increasing by definition, but in terms of the impacts in cities and societies, one of the most obvious of those impacts is these increasing heat events. And, you know, and they manifest in a number of warmer temperatures, even if you don't necessarily have more extreme daytime temperatures. So, for example, one of the trends that's been occurring, and this is true across most of the world, actually, is that more of the global warming that's occurred so far has been occurring at night rather than during the daytime. And one of the cases in which this becomes particularly problematic is during heat waves, where what it means is that not only do you have very hot temperatures during the daytime, but you have relatively even more unusually hot temperatures persisting through the nighttime hours. And so you're not getting that cool down. And so people don't have that ability, human bodies don't have the ability to reset at night, which a lot of public health experts have pointed out. These persistently warm overnight temperatures are actually an even greater threat to public health, especially for sensitive individuals, than the extreme daytime temperatures. But on the other hand, we have been seeing this increase in extremely hot daytime temperatures. And as you say, Southern California, just this past week, hit some new all-time high values. And as the planet continues to warm more generally, and as we continue to see increased frequency and intensity of heat waves in a global sense and here in California, we will sporadically hit these new ever higher thresholds of temperature extremes. Mm-hmm. So we hit some new values this July, and you know it could be another decade or another two decades before we hit the new all-time high value. But unfortunately, I mean that is essentially the direction that we're headed. We will, you know, most of us alive today will see a year where we hit yet higher values than we have now, and so that is the direction things are going. But the real question is how far down that path do we go? How much more warming is there, you know, and what kinds of temperature extremes do we see 50 years from now?
Wow.
And that question is largely still dependent on what we do in the coming decades with respect to carbon emissions. How much more greenhouse gases do we emit? Mm-hmm. And I think that's still a big open question.
Professor Diffenbaugh, what would you add?
Well, I certainly agree with what Daniel just stated, and part of the research that we've been conducting is to ask, what are the differences in the odds of these kinds of extreme events for different levels of global warming in the future? So we've looked at the historical period as we've discussed, and it's clear that these increasing odds of extreme heat have already emerged from the 1 degree Celsius of global warming we've already had. But, you know, the future is still an open book to some degree. So we've compared, for example, the probability of record-breaking heat events at 2 degrees Celsius, which is the target for the UN Paris Agreement as an outside boundary on warming. And then the UN Paris Agreement also states a goal of pursuing 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming. And so we've been able to compare the odds of extreme heat at those two thresholds, and it's clear that the more global warming there is, the more this intensification of extremes that we're already seeing emerging, the more severe that intensification will be in the future. And I think in considering those costs and benefits of achieving different levels of global warming, it's important to keep in mind that the physical climate is just one dimension of what influences the kinds of impacts that you were talking about earlier in terms of unrest associated with heat extremes, for example. And there's really an overlay between the physical environment and other conditions.
And Professor Diffenbaugh, talk about why the 2 degrees Celsius is so important. Just remind us why that is important. Your results also suggest that limiting global warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial conditions may not be sufficient to avoid serious increases in severely hot conditions.
Well, I think in some sense that's rather obvious because we're already experiencing increased odds of record-breaking heat extremes and other extremes in the present climate relative to 50 years ago, for example. So the warming that we've already had is, we're not prepared for the warming that we've already had. And that 2 degree level of global warming is twice the global warming that's already occurred. So even that very ambitious goal of curbing emissions and holding global warming to 2 degrees Celsius is a doubling of the global warming we've already had. And most research suggests that for a doubling of the global warming, we can expect at least a doubling in the frequency of extreme events, and certainly new records being set. So not only an increased frequency of what we have experienced as extreme, but equally important, emergence of unprecedented extremes as that global warming intensifies. And certainly, we know from looking at the number of records of, say, hot temperatures versus cold temperatures around the world, we know that this is already emerging. We're setting far more hot temperatures than we are cold temperatures. So we're already living in a world of unprecedented heat, and if we double the global warming that we've already had, that will be even more pervasive than it is now.
Noah Diffenbaugh is professor of Earth System Science at Stanford University. And Noah has just been appointed by the California Natural Resources Secretary John Laird to the state's Climate Safe Infrastructure Working Group. We're also joined today by Dr. Daniel Swain, climate scientist at the Center for Climate Science at UCLA. And today we are talking about extreme weather. We are really in unprecedented times, as you're hearing from our guest today. And there are just so many horrible cases of people dying around the globe from extreme heat. In May, 65 people in Pakistan died from a heat wave. And just last week, Peggy Frank, a postal carrier in Southern California, died in her truck. There was no air conditioning in her truck. There's going to be an investigation to find out what exactly happened, but it was 117 degrees that day. If you have any questions for our guests about the extreme weather that we are seeing around the globe, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if you'd like to talk about the changes that you're experiencing in your area, and what issues does this bring up for you if you're older or if you have relatives that are having a difficult time with the heat, especially if there's no air conditioning? This is definitely a climate justice issue, because in a lot of poor areas, they do not have climate change air conditioning. And we'll talk about how this affects people who are low income, people of color. If there's any issue around that you'd like to bring up, and if you're concerned about, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's talk a little bit about what we're dealing with in California and the state of the drought. We've done a lot of shows about the drought, the climate that we have here, typically dry summers, relatively wet winters, but we have experienced very long periods of drought. And according to the U.S. Drought Monitor, abnormally dry or drought conditions prevail over 85% of California, including the coast from Monterey County to the Oregon border. And Dr. Swain, what can you tell us about where we are right now when it comes to our drought status?
Well, you know, we actually have gone from drought briefly to flood and then sort of drifted back into drought across a significant portion of California over the past seven years or so. And, you know, what's interesting is that certain parts of the state arguably never really exited the drought in the first place that began about 6 or 7 years ago. And that's especially true in the southern portion of the state. Two winters ago, Northern California did see a particularly wet season, one of the wettest on record across the northern Sierra watersheds and even parts of the Bay Area. And that certainly did a lot to improve drought conditions. And from a sort of a superficial perspective, you know, the reservoir levels were right up to 100% of average and even above, so we filled up our human water systems pretty adequately during that wet winter. But I think what we're realizing increasingly is that that single kind of wet winter doesn't really break the drought in a broader context. It doesn't break the drought with respect to groundwater, which is still massively overdrafted and still declining across much of California. It doesn't break the drought in the forests of the Sierra Nevada, where there has been mortality on the order of hundreds of millions of trees due to a combination of drought-related stresses and bark beetle infestations. It doesn't necessarily break the drought in Southern California, where we never really had that very wet winter to begin with, but also where, you know, we've experienced really, really hot conditions in addition to the low precipitation, even over the past couple of years, which is continuing that trend from 5 years ago or more. So, you know, what we've seen is that while Northern California got a bit of a reprieve a couple of years ago, and even though water scarcity isn't necessarily on everyone's mind right now, that from an ecological perspective and from a broader perspective, this drought is definitely still with us.
Professor Diffenbaugh?
Yeah, I think what you were bringing up earlier, Rose, about environmental justice and who is impacted during these kinds of extremes is, you know, is really important when we think about what's going on in California and what has gone on over the last several years. You know, I and my family lived here on the Stanford campus. During the drought, we got a letter saying that we had to take a 15% cut in our domestic water use and that we couldn't water the sidewalk anymore. You know, we had to start keeping our domestic irrigation on the domestic plants and not on the driveway and the sidewalk anymore. Meanwhile, you know, in the Central Valley, there were communities that were without running water for many, many, many months. And that's within California. You know, that's within the fifth largest economy in the world. Some of the most wealthy communities in America and in the world, highest concentrations of wealth, and yet we have that disparity in impact. So for someone of privilege like myself, the drought was, you know, at worst an inconvenience, and for the most part was an intellectual curiosity. And for thousands of people in California, tens of thousands of people in California, it was a real human rights crisis in terms of, you know, the fundamental human right of access to clean drinking water. And that's in the human dimension. Daniel also mentioned the scale of tree mortality that occurred during the drought. And certainly that for riparian species, you know, for fish species, you know, the water managers during the drought were literally, you know, having to make decisions right on the edge of species extinction. You know, they were very concerned about whether the decisions they were making in real time would, you know, how could they keep
all of those populations, say of riparian fish, not only thriving but in some cases intact. So I think that your point about environmental justice is critical. And when we look around the world at where we're seeing these severe heat events during this summer in the Northern Hemisphere, we really see that the critical role that that exposure and vulnerability play, right? So there are places with much higher population densities with much less not only wealth but other resources available to withstand these kinds of climate shocks, these intense climate stresses, and you know, that's where you know, that combination of conditions is why extremes are so important, and why what might be small changes in the magnitude or frequency of occurrence of extremes can actually have very large impact.
Right. And the UFW over the last couple of weeks was sending out photos of farm workers in the Central Valley saying that those who belong to a union have the right to take a break and have access to water. But those who don't might not have just basic breaks and access to water. So that's also something that's very important to think about and to ask, why is that the case in a state like California? That is Noah Diffenbaugh. He's professor of earth system science at Stanford University. Dr. Daniel Swain is a climate scientist at the Center for Climate Science at UCLA. And on today's Your Call, it's our One Planet series, and we are talking about the oppressive levels of heat happening around the globe, and we're talking about the connections between global warming and extreme heat. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
It's the first summit between President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Trump says he thinks the two will get along. Is that because high-stakes topics might be left out of their discussion? Should the U.S. be allies or competitors with what many call a rogue state? The summit in Helsinki, next time on 1A.
You can hear 1A 1/2 hour from now here on 91.7 KALW. Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org. Or leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today it is our One Planet series, and we are talking about the oppressive levels of heat that we are seeing around the globe, from South Japan to Pakistan to Los Angeles. So many people are affected by the heat wave, and today we're talking about the connections between extreme heat and climate change. Today we're joined by Noah Diffenbaugh, professor of earth system science at Stanford University. Dr. Daniel Swain is a climate scientist at the Center for Climate Science at UCLA. And now I would like to welcome Dr. Martin Horling to the show. Dr. Horling is a meteorologist at NOAA's Earth System Research Lab in Boulder, Colorado. He's co-editor of the special supplement to the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society on Explaining Extreme Events from a Climate Perspective. Hi, Dr. Horling. Welcome to the show.
Yes, glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. A couple of months ago, a study by NOAA concluded that climate change driven by the buildup of human-caused greenhouse gases will overtake natural variability as the main cause of heat waves in the western U.S. by the late 2020s and by the mid-2030s in the Great Lakes. The lead author of the study, Josme Lopez, a meteorologist at NOAA, said, quote, "Without human influence, half of the extreme heat waves projected to occur in the future would not happen," end quote. So, Dr. Horling, can you talk about the links between human-caused climate change and extreme heat?
Well, I'd like to. I think the way I like to present it is starting with the global temperature of the planet, because all boats rise with the tide in the story. And so whether we're talking about a heat wave in Los Angeles or we're talking about a heat wave in Boulder or today in Helsinki, if you saw the news, or at the British Open this week, which has been in the throes of a heat wave, these regions are reacting in almost synchronicity with the rising global temperature. And the time series of global temperature is rather remarkable. Data for that goes back about 150 years or so. And basically since 1980, every year for the planet as a whole has been warmer than the average temperature of the 20th century. And this has just been a rising trend. There are some breaks in that from time to time. There may be a particular La Nina event, a cooling of the ocean, but the inexorable rise in the trend is very clear in all the data sets that are available to scientists to look at. And so the temperatures have risen by a little over a degree Celsius, depends exactly where you start your time series. So that's almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, in summertime, when we talk about heat waves, which is what you're doing, that's actually a significant temperature difference from a baseline, and you notice it. It's very perceptive, it's detectable, and so the study you mentioned is talking about whether you can distinguish with high confidence that an event that happens in 2020 or 2030 will be achieving a magnitude that simply could not have happened had we not increased the carbon dioxide. And so the evidence is certainly pointing to that from a variety of sources, not just the types of models that are used, but even just the observations are beginning to sort of reveal their hand of the warming world at the regional scale. So the regional scale where we live, Southern Cal, if you will, or wherever it may be, is increasingly at risk of higher temperatures than what it has experienced in the last 100 years.
Noah, you have been tracking this for a long time, extreme heat. What does the research say? How far have you gone back to map the changes?
Well, in our analysis, we've actually used for the historical observations where we've looked at different areas around the globe, we've used the historical temperature observations from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where Marty works. So we're using the same data that Marty just described.
Dr. Swain, what about this data? Are you also using the same data?
Yeah, I think climate scientists in general, you know, there's certain forms of shared data. Most of us, on some level, are working essentially with the same information because a lot of it's sort of centrally held and assessed and assimilated by NOAA, the NOAA, the organization, and these sorts of data sets are really valuable because they one's essentially looking at the same information to come to their conclusions. I think one of the really interesting things that Marty actually just pointed out is that recently, on the regional scale, we are starting to see these trends in the real world, whereas a decade or so ago, we knew that the global temperature was increasing, but there was less direct observational evidence that the really extreme events were increasing. Now, we're sort of far enough along that global warming path that in addition to the global mean temperature obviously increasing, we are starting to see this manifestation of an increase in the risk of events like extreme heat waves, for example, in particular regions. And that's a relatively new development, and it suggests that one of the key predictions from climate science from a long time ago is becoming validated essentially by observations of what's happening in the real world, and that's something that's somewhat new, at least with respect to extreme events.
Dr. Daniel Swain is a climate scientist at the Center for Climate Science at UCLA. Noah Diffenbaugh is professor of Earth System Science at Stanford. And Dr. Martin Horling is a meteorologist in NOAA's Earth System Research Lab in Boulder, Colorado. And let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was trying to find I was trying to find what the name of the British official was who said, like, by 2100 or 2050, that the gross world product, like the gross domestic product of the world, was going to be, that 20% of it was going to go towards climate mitigation, meaning dealing with whether it's rising seas and temperature and things like that. And that was at least 7 years ago, 10 years ago. Has there been any updates on that?
Yeah, so I was co-author on a publication that was led by Marshall Burke, who's an economist here at Stanford. Just came out in May, and what we did was we based on historical relationships between temperature variations in each country around the world and the economic growth in those respective countries, we compared the probability of economic impacts in different countries around the globe at 2 degrees of global warming versus 1.5 degrees of global warming, the two targets that are prominent in the UN Paris Agreement, and then also compared those levels with higher levels that are commensurate with the trajectory that we've been on historically. And what we found actually is that the likely reduction in economic damages, say between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees, is actually an order of magnitude greater than the latest estimates of the costs for the mitigation costs for being on a trajectory consistent with that lower global warming level. So, in fact, the latest research suggests that the avoided costs of lower global warming, the damages that are avoided by achieving a lower level of global warming, are actually likely to be substantially greater than the cost of achieving that lower level of global warming.
Dr. Swain, do you have anything to add on that one?
Well, I mean, I think you know, sort of in line with the research that Noah was just talking about, is that, you know, there have been various estimates over the years of exactly, you know, what the economic costs of either not mitigating climate change or of actually doing, you know, going pretty far down the path of mitigation, and they're always very big numbers. It's always going to be an expensive problem to address. The question is whether sort of we address it preemptively before we incur a lot of those costs now, or whether we wait decades and wait until it becomes a lot more expensive to deal with these things. And, you know, we talk about things in terms of economic costs, but there are some things that simply can't be addressed even if you throw a lot of money at it. You know, you can build seawalls, you can increase resilience to floods, for example, or to heat waves, but you can only do that to a certain degree. And so, you know, there's also these costs that are, you know, economists have attempted to quantify when ramping it up into one big number, but there are some sort of costs that are also kind of unquantifiable because they aren't necessarily just financial costs, but they are costs, you know, to the ways of life people are used to, or costs to the environment, or costs to equity in a socioeconomic context. And a lot of these things are not always directly captured by these big GDP metrics, but that's an important place to start. If you want to put numbers on it somehow, that's a language that a lot of people sort of share.
And Dr. Horling, with NOAA, what would you add?
Well, of course, that's not my expertise. I'll give that disclaimer to begin with. I will just mention from the experience related to the Sandy, the Superstorm Sandy that affected the Battery, the lower Manhattan region, when it made its sort of landfall as a very intense storm, it brought a surge of water that went into the Battery and filled some of the subways. Sea level is one of the very clear signals of a warming world. The sea level rise occurs because the ocean is warming and expands, and so the height of the sea surface rises. And now glaciers, the glacial melt is actually accelerating the rate at which the sea level rises. Now, folks in Northern Europe have invested over the decades in infrastructure that protects the coasts from these storm-related surges when the seas are rising on top of that. Not so much perhaps in the U.S., this is my sense, it's a personal view, but just to give you an idea, I mean, the extra roughly 12 inches of sea level that became available to flood lower Manhattan because of the trend of about 1 foot increase in sea level in that area had a devastating effect. The cost to mitigate that is substantial. I won't throw a number out, but it's certainly within the means of society to sustain it. But it's a matter of the willpower to invest in that in advance, knowing that there'll be more storms of the same type that will occur, even if they're not becoming stronger, they'll be riding on a higher sea, forcing more water into these coastal communities. And it would probably be true on the West Coast as well as it would be on the East Coast, where you have exposed infrastructure.
Well, thank you for that call. Let's go to another caller, Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I'm not very optimistic about what's going to be happening in the near future with climate change. I did notice recently there was a lot of publicity given to the fact that what I think it's ice in Antarctica was melting at phenomenal rates. It was just mind-boggling, the amount. So what I'm curious about is, given the kinds of changes that would have to take place in the way governments act, the way societies act, the way individuals act, how optimistic are your guests that that this will happen quickly enough to at least mitigate, if not avoid, catastrophic breakdown, and therefore just a absolute horrible scenario for everyone on the planet in the future if this isn't addressed? And I don't see that movement taking place. You'd think that people would be saying, hey, look, we're killing the environment we're living in. We're going to kill ourselves. We need to do something about this. But I don't see that in mass, not only in the United States, but even around the world. There may be other countries that are doing something better, but I just don't see that happening. So I'd love to hear what they have to say.
Well, thank you. Dr. Horling, you're a meteorologist at NOAA, and we've done so many shows about what has happened at the EPA under Scott Pruitt. We did shows about the Trump administration wanting to cut NOAA's budget by so much money, and this is an institution that is so crucial to the planet, really, and so many scientists rely on your data. So how would you address that question?
Well, I think first, observing what's happening and having the reliable facts available and maintaining those observing capabilities is really key. So when your caller was mentioning the ice loss in the Arctic, in fact, NOAA has an Arctic report card. It monitors the Arctic, not just the temperature and precipitation and weather patterns, but also the ecosystem, fish, marine species, and, of course, the ice. And he's right. I mean, in terms of a canary in the coal mine, I just want to come back to this one, because what's happening at the top of the world from a Northern Hemisphere perspective was expected, if I can say that, without being sounding smart about it, but the science had foreseen that the place that would be first sensitive, particularly to a warming world, would be the ice in the sea, in the Arctic Ocean, that it would retreat, and it would retreat at a rapid rate, and it has done that. It requires satellites, in situ data, a substantial, sophisticated observing system to monitor the pace at which that's happening, and then thereby to validate or refute the models that we use to foresee how and why this would be happening. The data are confirming the predictions. I think Daniel made that statement. It's really important to note that these expectations were laid down a good 25 or more years ago in the first Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports. Those models that were used to foresee what would happen in the early 21st century are being, by and large, verified in many of their details, and the changing Arctic sea ice is a key element to that. It's the canary in the coal mine. Global mean temperatures have risen about 2 degrees Fahrenheit since the late 19th century, but the temperatures at the polar cap have outstripped that pace by a factor of more than 2. So there's radical changes in the environment happening there, and those will spread. There will be increasing warming elsewhere. So NOAA's strength is monitoring what's happening. It's trying to explain why what you're seeing is happening and what this rate of change is likely to mean for the future. So it's also engaged in making the projections as what's likely to happen next. That's the mission of NOAA.
And that's Dr. Martin Horling, a meteorologist in NOAA's Earth System Research Lab in Boulder, Colorado. Professor Diffenbaugh, what would you add?
Well, I think stepping back to a broader view of the caller's question, what really makes, really creates the challenge around global warming and climate change is that it is caused by a side effect of
energy consumption. So the the CO2 and other greenhouse gases that humans have emitted to the atmosphere, continue to emit to the atmosphere, are primarily driven by fossil fuel use, by agriculture, land clearing for agriculture, and so those are important activities for humanity. There's tremendous benefit that comes from having access to modern energy resources, and the challenge that the caller describes is a large one. In order to meet the United Nations global warming goals, the physics of the planetary energy balance, just the basic physics of Earth's temperature, require that essentially the greenhouse gas emissions will need to reach something close to net zero emissions. So essentially, in net, decarbonizing the energy system. And that's just the climate part of the lens. But if you look at the great disparity in energy access around the world, and the magnitude of the populations that are in energy poverty now, and the tremendous humanitarian costs of that energy poverty in terms of lacking access to electricity, lacking access to clean water, lacking access to clean cooking fuel, the indoor air pollution, the health costs of cooking with biomass in an enclosed space. These are fundamental human development challenges, and so really, decarbonizing the energy system will really have to go along with increasing global energy supply and energy access, and those are twin challenges. They go hand in hand. That both that climate sustainability and that energy equity, those go hand in hand. And as we discussed earlier, we're already experiencing impacts from the 1 degree Celsius of global warming that's already happened. At 2 degrees, we'll experience greater impacts. And so, even if we are able to both simultaneously increase global energy supply and access and reduce greenhouse gas emissions simultaneously, we will also have to continue to adapt to further climate change. So I guess that's another way of stating what the caller was stating, but these are each daunting challenges in and of themselves, and doing all three simultaneously is even more challenging. The good news is that there are opportunities to meet those challenges. And I would argue that California is one of the places that we haven't solved the problem yet. And what we have done so far is not perfect, but we certainly have begun to head down the path of both reducing greenhouse gas emissions while supporting a thriving economy and increasing equity.
And that is Noah Diffenbaugh, professor of Earth System Science at Stanford University. And Dr. Swain, what would you add to that question?
Well, I think to sort of address the caller's question directly, I have a mix of optimism and pessimism on that front. And that largely stems from the fact that there is no immediate on-off switch in the climate system. And that's true both with respect to our carbon emissions. We're not immediately going to be able to switch off our carbon economy tomorrow. And it also has to do with the physical climate system itself, which is to say, even if we did manage to switch off our carbon emissions tomorrow, the Earth would continue to warm for a while. And so there is sort of this inertia in the way we do things with respect to how we generate, how we do agriculture, essentially every aspect of the way we live our lives. And I say we, I really am referring to pretty much everybody on Earth, that isn't going to change overnight. And so to at least a significant degree, there will be additional global warming no matter what we do. But that said, there's still a huge range of possible future outcomes from this point forward. And it seems relatively unlikely at this point that we're going to end up with seeing less than an additional degree Celsius of warming. So we probably will eventually end up hitting this 2 degrees Celsius threshold eventually. But there's a really big difference between 2 degrees or 3 degrees or 4 degrees or more in the future. And we do still have the capacity to sort of choose between those paths, between 2 degrees or a much higher number. And the good news is there isn't necessarily a cliff that we fall off of at 2.1 degrees, if that's where we end up, or 2.5 degrees. Obviously, the impacts with respect to extreme events, for example, increase as you go further down that path, but there isn't necessarily a discrete point where all hope is lost. It's always, I think, going to be better to get to a lesser level of warming than a higher level of warming. And so what that means is even if we overshoot our sort of really optimistic goals, there's still a reason to try really hard to get there because less is always going to be better. So that's sort of my reason for a mix of the pessimism and the optimism. It's a big challenge, and we are committed to additional global warming, but we're not committed to as much warming as we could go down that path if we make the right decisions today.
Dr. Daniel Swain is a climate scientist at the Center for Climate Science at UCLA. Dr. Swain, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Noah Diffenbaugh is professor of Earth System Science at Stanford University. Professor Diffenbaugh, as always, thank you for joining us. Thank you for all of your work.
Thank you.
And Dr. Martin Horling is a meteorologist in NOAA's Earth System Research Lab in Boulder, Colorado. Dr. Horling, thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you back to talk more about the important work that NOAA does and what life is like there under the Trump administration.
That was my pleasure.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about the future of Roe v. Wade. With the Supreme Court nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, so many people are concerned that Roe could be overturned. It's shocking to even say this in 2018, as 70,000 women die from unsafe abortions every year around the globe. Advocates say that number is much higher. So if this were to happen, what choice would this leave women and girls with? How would providers respond? What kind of future would this spell for reproductive care in the United States? That is tomorrow. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can leave us a review. Follow us on Twitter to find out what's coming up and to find out highlights of the show at Your Call Radio. You can email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Sydney Johnson is our intern. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.